Hello, and this is the February 20th, 2015 edition of WFAE Talks, our newsroom podcast. I'm Greg Collard, news director at WFAE, and this week we're joined by someone new, not new to the newsroom, certainly, but new to WFAE Talks, Mark Rumsey.
Hey there.
Hi. You're known as our All Things Considered host. You're on every day, very well-known voice on WFAE, but you are also our public conversations coordinator, a very important position. We basically, a few times a year, go out in the community and have a public conversation about an important topic. And this last one we had was on end-of-life planning and choices.
Right. Something that, you know, as we said at the forum and everybody agreed, I guess, isn't the first thing that most people want to, you know, kind of get together and chat about or find it hard to do. But I thought it was pretty neat that we had about 175 or so people come out to talk about this.
People were really interested in it, and that's, yeah, it's funny you say that. You know, we assume people don't want to talk about it, but maybe more people do than we realized, or maybe it's just something all in our – it's certainly all on our minds, but we want to talk about it but then are afraid to.
Yeah.
You had a great panel of guests. I want to play a soundbite from one of your panelists, Jillian Tullis. She's assistant professor of communications at UNC Charlotte, and her basic point was, hey, this is part of life. Death is part of life. We need to talk about it.
Any conversation about dying and death is really about living. I mean, that's absolutely the case. And I think if you think about what type of life you want to have, that's going to influence, you know, very likely the types of choices that you're going to want to make around your dying and death. So for me, it is about embracing how I want to live.
I thought that really stayed with me throughout the night. Any conversation about death is really a conversation about living, essentially. Mm-hmm. I think that was an interesting way to talk about this.
And several of the panelists echoed that in one way or another. That was a common theme of the night.
Well, what are your takeaways for this? You were the moderator of this event. Were you encouraged by the conversation? What stuck out to you?
Well, I was encouraged, and one of the primary goals for doing this public conversation was to give people useful information, sort of on the theory that one way to help overcome the fear or the reticence to talk about death and dying and end-of-life planning is to give people information, some tools, and so that's why we had the expert panel that we did and also talked a good bit about what are broadly known as advanced care directives, these documents that we've all heard something about, such as a living will.
So, and that's basically telling people in advance that this is in the event that I'm dying, this is how I want to die, or I don't want a feeding tube. I'm putting it very simply, but that's essentially what these documents are.
Yeah. The living wills came around, I guess, in about the 70s, so they've been around for quite a while, with sort of the more autonomous approach to having the patient declare in advance on the premise that the day may come when the patient's not able to speak for him or herself any longer. So the living will was designed to do that. The other major document that we talked quite a bit about at the forum was one called the Healthcare Power of Attorney. And that is basically where the patient or the person in advance, while they're still of sound health and mind, they designate someone who would speak for them in these medical decisions in the event that they are in one way or another incapacitated.
How often is this beneficial to people? Have you learned anything about that?
Well, that was part of the discussion. I think there's kind of a common narrative out in our culture now that the living will is, even though the majority of people don't have them, that everybody should have one. That's kind of the prevailing mentality. But one of our other panelists was Dr. Lance Stell. He's a medical ethicist on the faculty at Davidson College and also with Carolina's Medical Center. We've got him here with a different take on the living will.
While it was imagined to be a way to direct care, I have to say in my experience, I've never seen it make things go better, and I've often seen it make things go worse.
Wow.
Because people direct their attention to these terms and what they think they mean and how they would be interpreted by the person who wrote the document, and a lot of desultory conversations result, struggling with the living will.
So what are some types of terms that people might be confused about that have different interpretations of that are common in living wills?
I think right before that, he referred to the dilemmas that can come up medically in trying to determine if a patient is in a, quote, persistent vegetative state.
Mm-hmm.
How is that determined? How does everybody agree on that? Do medical personnel even always agree on that? And I remember him saying, no,
mm-hmm.
That's not clearly defined.
Is that where the importance of the healthcare power of attorney comes into play when there are these disagreements and maybe you need someone to speak for you who knows what your intentions were and can convey that to the appropriate people?
Right, presumably. And also that the healthcare power of attorney who's there in the then and the here and now, the living will may have been done years mm-hmm. and years ago. The healthcare power of attorney is speaking to the doctors then in the moment, looking at the actual situation, knowing whatever we know today about medical care and ethical decisions and so forth. And yes, keeping in mind whatever that patient told the healthcare power of attorney back at a time when they were able to communicate. And that's why all the panelists really stress the importance of having those conversations.
That's got to be such a tough job, I imagine, being a healthcare power of attorney when you're dealing with such sensitive issues and people have different, you know, religious beliefs come into play. Just their different people's different moral beliefs, morality systems come into play. I mean, you're just having to deal with a lot.
Yeah, right. It's a heavy thing, and I'm sure we didn't really go there in our discussion, but I'm sure that all of our expert panelists would have agreed that not to be taken lightly by anyone.
So. How many people do get a healthcare power of attorney? How common is even less common than a living will?
The figures I can't break those down between the two different documents, but I know when Michael Tomczyk on our staff did a story in advance of our public conversation, he and I were both looking at a lot of the research and figures, and all the numbers that are sticking in my mind are in the like 20 to 30% range mm-hmm. for these documents. So it's definitely a minority of people that have them in place.
Okay. Well, what did you learn from this? What do you think? What are you personally? What new perspectives did you get out of this?
One thing, this also goes back to Michael's story where he spoke with an attorney in Charlotte who partially makes a living helping people fill out these mm-hmm. advanced care directives. And she gave the anecdote from her own home where her husband doesn't have one yet and she hasn't been able to get him to fill one out. And we also had a chaplain in the audience at our conversation who also spends a significant amount of time in the hospital setting helping people fill these forms out, and she acknowledged there in the public forum that she doesn't have advanced directives for herself in place either. So one thing that I took away from our discussion is just sort of confirmation of the fact that we just really don't want to take the time or get into the detail to mm-hmm. deal with this. And plus, it's intimidating. We looked at those forms in a little bit more detail, and there's a lot of places to check this and check that and initial this and initial that. And it's kind of intimidating, can be.
I'll admit I have never had this discussion with my parents, and my wife and I have had some basic discussions, but nothing in depth. I mean, mm-hmm. I've never addressed this.
Mm-hmm. Well, welcome to the majority.
How about you?
Have had a little bit of discussion with my parents. But that's about the extent of it.
Well, mm-hmm. and it's weird because I don't know if my parents would would mind the discussion. It's I put it more on me. Mm-hmm. I'm not the types to bring things up, but I hesitate to bring it up more than anything. I wonder have you noticed anything where parents are more willing to talk about it than their kids?
Just a general observation that the older we get, the more aware we are of our mortality, and when we start seeing when people start seeing their peers, you know, people in their demo, if you will, more and more frequenting, you know, the obituary page, then
my mother-in-law sends me all the obits from back home all the time about who's died. You're right. I thought some of the audience comments were just really interesting. I mean, that we had someone who had mentioned that to get them to, and I hope I'm remembering this correctly, but it's off the top of my head, but someone had talked about a friend taking them through a funeral home.
Yeah, I mean, I had thrown the question out to the audience, how have any of you sort of gotten over the hump with this topic of death and dying to where you can talk about it more easily? And there was a man who spoke up and said, well, he had a friend who either runs or works at a funeral home, and he basically did a walkthrough. And he talked about going in, you know, the morgue or, you know, kind of getting right down to the nitty-gritty. And he said for him, that experience took some of the mystique out of the whole subject.
One of the things that we didn't get around to talking a whole lot about that we had hoped to was something called a most form. Mm-hmm. This is one of these, I guess, very important forms, but it has very bureaucratic language to it.
A little bit. Most,
what is a most form?
That is another form under this umbrella category of advance directives for healthcare. And it's an acronym. It stands for Medical Order or Orders Scope of Treatment. And so the most form is something that the physician signs, as opposed to the living will and the healthcare power of attorney being something that is directed by the patient, signed by the patient. So this is a way of putting orders in place within a healthcare setting, such as a hospital, where a physician has signed the orders directing the staff, this is how this patient is to be treated or not treated. Mm-hmm. And one application that Lance Stell gave of that is out in the field as well. So this most form is designed to be portable, as he described it, so that, for instance, when EMTs are called, as Dr. Stell was saying, if they don't have any legal forms to slow them down, even if the person has a document somewhere that says they're a DNR, a do not resuscitate, mm-hmm. The medics, their protocol is, Dr. Stell put it by saying it's like the Marines have landed. That they come in and their job is to resuscitate and preserve life. So this most form, in theory, would allow, if it declared and a physician had given the order, do not resuscitate on this patient, then the medics, according to Dr. Stell, would respect that or would be adhering to that.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing their job when they, right. when otherwise they're doing their job. But in this case, this form, in theory, would prevent the resuscitation that the patient doesn't want.
But you when you're coming in, I mean, this is where electronic records come into play, I guess, because you're not looking for forms when you're coming in trying to resuscitate people all the time.
They're by training, and you know, I think we would be glad that they are
sure.
trained to hit the scene and do, you know, what they're supposed to do. So, yeah, if there's if the patient's incapacitated at that point, I guess it would be on a family member mm-hmm. to produce that form.
Right.
And I think this is probably where a lot of the vagaries and imperfections of these documents come
sure.
into play.
Yeah. Well, one of the struggles we sometimes have with these public conversations events, Mark, is continuing the conversation. That's one reason we want to continue a smaller conversation on this podcast, but I get the feeling that this is something that maybe this is going to be a little bit easier to continue the conversation, even though it's a difficult topic for us to discuss, because I know we had a lot of story ideas to come out of this, and so that conversation will continue through some stories we're going to do on WFAE. But what kind of feedback have you received on this? I have a feeling that there's a lot to go with this topic.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is. And after our public conversations, we always do a survey of our attendees. And I've had a chance to look at responses from dozens of our attendees from the other night. So there's feedback in there, and as you might expect, a number of the people that came to this forum would like to hear more discussion and potentially in the future more forums looking at different angles on this issue. So that's certainly a possibility down the road. We've also put some links at WFAE.org on our public conversations page, directing people to information, including copies and booklets about the advanced directives that we've been discussing here.
Maybe you can do your own little separate public conversation podcast to follow up on some of these topics people bring up that they'd like further addressed after each.
That could be good.
Maybe that'll come up in for goals.
June is coming
up when it comes to evaluation. So anyway, great job. You did a great job as a host, and I thought it was just a really nice event and informative. And I think I haven't had those conversations yet with my family, but at least I'm thinking about it differently, and I think maybe some other people are too, hopefully.
Yeah, I think so. And I think for all of us, it's not about being guilt-tripped into having those conversations. It's just being a little better informed and feeling a little more free to try having that conversation.
All right. Well, Mark, thanks for your time. And we'll have to have you on again about another topic too.
I'll be here.
All right.